third lecture. Before we introduce our guest speaker, may I just remind you that we're delighted to have so many people here, members and non-members. We particularly welcome non-members to come and attend these lectures. We would ask if you would be so interested, though, to join the Institute, because it's only by the donations to those who join that we are able to keep the Institute going. So don't stay away from the meetings because of that, but we would be happy if you could see fit to join. We are very honored tonight and fortunate to have as our guest speaker Professor Alex Woodside, professor in the Department of History here and formerly professor in Chinese and Southeast Asian history from Harvard. Professor Woodside comes from Toronto to British Columbia via Harvard, where he obtained his doctorate. He's written several books on the Vietnamese and in Southeast Asia. And I think you will all agree that he's eminently qualified to speak to us tonight on his topic of China and Vietnam, the new era. Dr. Woodside.
I should like to spend most of my time considering the crisis which has gripped China since the death of, and in fact before the death of, Mao Zedong. Can everybody hear? And save a few comments on the reconstruction and transformation of Vietnam until the end. It is, in a sense, an act of almost cosmic effrontery on my part to try to combine in just 60 minutes a discussion of the revolution in the world's largest communist state with a discussion of the revolution in the world's third largest communist state. The only intellectual excuse for doing so, apart from the fact that I specialize, however inadequately, in the history of these two countries, is that both of them are Asian peasant societies with high cultures which used to be heavily Confucian, where communist revolutionary movements seized power with impressive domestic grassroots, rice roots, if you like, support. And these three basic characteristics, I think, place China and Vietnam in a category by themselves. To the general public, the study of contemporary Chinese politics must seem a curious enterprise. In some ways, it's undoubtedly the Loch Ness monster of the academic world, because you always have the discouraging impression, or I think the public probably has the discouraging impression, that the soundings that you are taking in the sometimes less than crystalline depths of Chinese politics almost always miss some elusive, elastic, historically adventurous presence of some sort lurking at the very bottom of them. Up on the surface, the news from China is that a so-called anti-party group known as the Gang of Four, including Mao Zedong's widow, a minority faction among the several hundred members of the Chinese Communist Party Central Committee, tried to seize power in China and are currently being repressed. We're told that this gang of four tried to make the city of Shanghai a principal battlefront in their struggle against their enemies, and that they hoped to use their control over the Shanghai People's Militia as a weapon. the Shanghai People's Militia was forced to publish a front-page declaration of loyalty to Hua Guofeng, the new chairman, in Chinese newspapers in early November. We're told, among other things, that this Gang of Four challenged the more elderly members of the officers' corps of the Chinese army, insinuating that these officers were formalists and conservatives who were all too willing to postpone further social revolution at home in order to build up Chinese military power against Russian and American threats, which these officers tendentiously exaggerated. We're told that this Gang of Four, led by Wang Hongwen, schemed to take over the Communist Party in Zhejiang Province, a very rich southeastern province in China, which for at least two centuries has been famous for being the homeland of large numbers of ambitious, job-seeking, sometimes politically discontented intellectuals. The Gang of Four apparently found it relatively easy to recruit supporters in the very beautiful city of Hangzhou and to seize control of important Hangzhou textile factories. And then they attempted, unsuccessfully, we're told, to attach their supporters to the regular Communist Party organization, provincial organization in Zhejiang, by means of the formula of storming into the party. That is, asking the Zhejiang Party organization to set aside its normal rules of membership recruitment, and so on. In other words, the party and the army have been the theaters of titanic political struggles. The public dramatization of the iniquities of the Gang of Four has been very Chinese. That is, it has depended upon and tried to exploit the vast sense of history of the Chinese people. For example, articles have appeared in Chinese newspapers recently asserting that Zheng Qing was an admirer of the Empress Dowager, Zixi, the poorly educated woman ruler who presided over China's decadence at the end of the 19th century. This is a woman who squandered the navy budget on the construction of palaces for herself and built a network of political followers on the basis of her marriage. These newspaper articles linking Zheng Qing to the Empress Dowager have been incredibly detailed and ornate. You don't get any idea of how detailed they've been from reading the Western press. Chinese newspapers have even recently published photographs of the text of the infamous Treaty of 1901. This is a treaty in which the Empress Dowager's government, after the Boxer Rebellion of 1900, agreed to pay a large indemnity to foreign powers in order to preserve itself. And photographs of this, the text of this, have appeared in Chinese newspapers. One might ask in passing, are these history-loaded attacks upon Zheng Qing, are they anti-feminist? In the sense that they breathe new life into ancient Chinese prejudices reinforced by centuries of Confucian historians, male Confucian historians, against conniving female rulers. China's current rulers appear to be sensitive enough to this accusation to have organized a public commemoration of the revolutionary virtues of Yang Kaihui, Mao Zedong's first wife, who was executed by the Kuomintang in 1930. The moral of this seems to be that all Mao's wives are not evil, just the one who happens to be a prominent living politician. In general, however, Zheng Qing has been accused, learnedly accused, in very learned articles in the Chinese press by everybody from scholars at the Chinese Science Academy to the workers at Peking factories. She's accused of having wished to become an empress of China, like the Empress Wu, who came to the throne in 690 AD, or like the wife of the founder of the Han Dynasty, who cast aside all her husband's old ministers after his death in 199 BC, a woman named Liu Ho. What are we to make of all this? At times, China seems to be a place where even the peasants all talk like the late André Malraux. Everybody from barbers to department store workers in China seem to flit from one majestic historical allusion to another with a kind of swashbuckling scholasticism that Westerners find very daunting. Especially if they're unfamiliar with the history of medieval China. Oracular history, if you can call it that, oracular history has always been as much a Chinese passion, I think, as oracular anthropology or oracular psychology or nowadays oracular social biology have been the passions of 20th century Westerners. The normal Western reaction to the riddle of Chinese politics has been not to meditate upon the different cultural modes of conceiving of political change, which exist in China and in the West, but to fall back upon one of two types of explanation of things Chinese. The first type of explanation has it that the Chinese willfully fabricate a kind of esoteric political merry-go-round in their country as a means of confusing foreigners and keeping foreigners at a distance. This type of Western explanation was especially popular with 19th century Western missionaries in China, many of whom, for obvious reasons, applied it first and foremost to the intractabilities of the Chinese language. Thus, an American missionary named Justice Doolittle published a famous book about 100 years ago, well, in 1865, 111 years, 12 years ago, entitled The Social Life of the Chinese. The Social Life of the Chinese. And in this book, Doolittle asserted, perfectly seriously, that Christian missionaries were being impeded in China because the Chinese language had been invented by the devil. As he put it, who endeavored by it to prevent the prevalence of Christianity in a country where he has so many zealous and able students, unquote. I might add that Doolittle and his wife, being a tough 19th century personages, they regarded the devil's invention of the Chinese language simply as a sporting challenge. Afraid that her friends might get the wrong idea, Mrs. Doolittle wrote, "Do not think that I am disappointed or discouraged with the Chinese people. One who has read St. Paul's description of heathenism ought to expect all we meet with." Well, in the 20th century, as you know, we've all conspired to treat the devil as if he were nothing but a museum piece. But it's not impossible in 1977 to find secularized echoes of Justice Doolittle's 1865 missionary psychology in those Western newspapers and journals which talk about the current Chinese crisis. They talk, I'm taking this from Newsweek of a few weeks ago, but it could be taken from practically any periodical. They talk extravagantly of shadowy groups in China, little-known strongmen, radical zealots, party economic wizards. The human chances are that there probably are not very many more economic wizards in the Chinese government than there are in our own. And you all know how many that is. but they talk about, they talk as if Chinese politics deliberately avoided otherwise universal and average human standards of rationality and complexity. And related to this is a Western tendency, the second type of reaction I mentioned, to discuss Chinese political history mainly in terms of high-ranking leaders and celebrated individual personalities, all of whom are supposedly engaged in nothing very much more than a personal struggle for power. This Western tendency, I think, can be traced back at least as far as the French philosopher Montesquieu in the early 18th century. He depicted what he called Asiatic governments as being despotisms without much inherent moderation or much law and order or much in the way of decisive political structures with some independence of the despot. And I'm afraid that modernized versions of Montesquieu's attitude towards Chinese history are very much with us in our scholarship and in our press and so on. Okay, well, it would be false of me to suggest that there is no struggle for power raging in China now. It would be false of me to suggest that Chinese history has not been marked both by severe struggles over political successions to dead rulers and by violent political reversals of a great variety, which have ranged from the harrowing to the absurd. One could think of many examples. You think, for example, of the great 12th century Chinese philosopher Zhu Xi, sometimes called the St. Thomas Aquinas of China. He was very important, and I suppose that comparison suggests it. He was one of the most important philosophers in world history. At the age of 65, in the 12th century, Zhu Xi lost a factional battle at the Chinese court and was promptly accused by his opponents of being a seducer of Buddhist nuns, 65, of being a teacher of students who were cattle thieves, and of being an unfilial son who fed his mother only low-grade rice. It's hard to think of two people in Chinese history who have less in common than Zhu Xi and Jiang Qing. But both of them have probably been victimized by political habits of slander that can be every bit as intemperate as those you would find in the West. In our own 20th century, there's a very great Chinese reformer, Liang Qichao, who wrote a very famous newspaper article in 1904 in which he stated that he was terrified in 1904, terrified of the growing prospect of a revolution in China. And the reason that he gave for his horror of a revolution in China, he told his readers, was that he felt that the type of political stabilization which followed transfers of power in China would be inevitably accompanied by violence and would last a longer time than it would after revolutions in the West. And he said the reason for this was that the political stabilization that occurred after a revolution in China, he was writing this in 1904, the political stabilization that occurred after a revolution in China, Liang Qichao wrote in 1904, would be like the stabilization you would get, this is a very Chinese analogy for you, it would be like the kind of stabilization you would get if you put 100 fighting crickets in a cage. Half would be killed off after a few days. 60% or 70% of the fighting crickets would be dead after a few more days. 80% or 90% would be dead after a few more days. And only when all the fighting crickets in the cage except one were dead would the fighting in the cricket cage come to an end. And Liang Qichao was an opponent of revolution. He was an opponent of the idea of violent revolution in China. In other words, because he felt that Chinese politics traditionally demanded a government legitimized by the virtues of one single heroic moral paragon, and that no Chinese ruler could ever feel that he had established his public monopoly of those moral virtues in the eyes of other Chinese as long as there were plausible opposing heroes at large in Chinese society who had not been settled with in one way or another. In other words, the Chinese tendency to have morally centralized government, not institutionally centralized government necessarily, but morally centralized, one person at the very top who's a sort of teacher ruler. Now, Chinese communist theoreticians would dispute that theory of Chinese politics. They would tell you that it was conservative or reactionary, and they would certainly say that it was utterly inappropriate to the China of the 20th century. I merely mention it to show you that you can find perceptive Chinese political observers who have been alarmed by the destructiveness and by the time-consuming fundamentalism, you might say, of struggles for power in a country as big as China, and with China's traditions of moral centralization of leadership in one person. So one can't deny that there's a power struggle in China. It would also, I think, be false of me to suggest that the spirit of compromise has expanded very notably within Chinese politics in the 20th century. Revolutionaries, as you know, rarely regard compromise as one of the more extraordinarily attractive virtues. Chinese revolutionaries have particularly vivid reasons for not appreciating the beneficence of public compromises with their opponents. For one thing, they've been betrayed and undone by compromises historically, as in 1927. And for another thing, there's an important school of thought in modern China which believes that one of the most damaging characteristics of the old pre-revolutionary China was its search for harmony, the so-called yielding nature of the Chinese people, even in circumstances of intolerable adversity. As one Chinese philosopher put it in a famous book, which he wrote in 1922, Liang Shuming, he said the greatest shortcoming, what he called the greatest shortcoming of Chinese civilization compared to the West, was the fact that, as he put it, the Chinese people absolutely, his word, lacked Western attitudes of resistance and struggle and so on. Now, obviously, it's quite untrue that the Chinese people lacked attitudes of resistance and struggle back in the pre-modern period. He was wrong. But the point is that there are many sensitive Chinese thinkers in this century, in the 20th century, who have believed that lack of struggle was a basic Chinese weakness before the 20th century. And these thinkers and doers are resolved to eradicate what they regard as a dangerously ingrained Chinese predisposition to complacence, docility almost, the search for harmony. Mao Zedong preached struggle. You have to bear in mind it's against this background. The great Chinese revolutionary novelist, Lu Xun, published a very famous short novel in 1921, a short novel called The True Story of A.Q., strange name, strange to the Chinese, strange to us, capital A-H and then Q, The True Story of A.Q. It would be safe to say, I think, that almost every Chinese schoolboy and Chinese schoolgirl is familiar with the chief character in this short novel, The True Story of A.Q. The chief character in the novel is a feckless village laborer named A.Q., who is always being victimized or maltreated or defeated in one of life's skirmishes, after one after another. But he always manages to make a sort of private rationalization of his defeats, which allows him to think of his defeats as having been victories. So that when younger village idlers beat him up in the novel, A.Q. pretends to himself that it's a case of a father having been beaten up by his own sons, and that's a moral outrage, just because they're younger toughs than he is. And this enables him to salvage a sense of moral superiority, even though he's lost the fight. And I think this novel and other writings like it have tended to put several generations of Chinese revolutionaries on guard against making compromises or accepting incomplete spiritual victories that would seem too much like A.Q.ism, as it sometimes is, too much like the self-deceptions and the overly accommodating behavior of the old China, which the novelist Lu Xun is attacking. This may seem a bit, I'm not sure how much this sense this makes to you, but if you want to know what A.Q.ism would be like in the Canadian context, read the new second edition of the Literary History of Canada, Canadian Literature in English, in which Professor Northrop Frye tells us that because the United States has become more introverted and less self-confident after Vietnam and Watergate, quote, "perhaps it's not too presumptuous to say that the American way of life is slowly becoming Canadianized," unquote. In other words, we can take pride in our lack of national self-confidence because it just might become a model of worldwide significance. Well, this is a perfect demonstration of Canadian A.Q.ism, and the Chinese would tell you. Another Canadian A.Q., I suppose, would be John Holmes of the Canadian Institute of International Affairs, who recently wrote that it was a blessing for Canada that the United States had acquired Alaska, because if we had acquired it, we would have been burdened with the defense of Alaska's borders against the USSR, and thus would probably have had to allow many American military bases to be established on its soil. Luckily, according to the Holmes argument, we didn't get Alaska, and so we avoid the American interference with our sovereignty that such an acquisition would have made inevitable. Well, I think you now see what the Chinese mean by A.Q.ism. And the point is that what I might call the anti-A.Q. theme in the Chinese Revolution, the distaste which Chinese revolutionaries have cultivated for defeats which are disguised as victories, the distaste which Chinese revolutionaries have cultivated for concessions to opponents, which are clumsily rationalized as advantages to oneself when they aren't, and so on, this has probably made whatever struggles for power have occurred in Chinese politics, it may have made them more prolonged and even more painful than they would have been anyway. There's been a revolutionary reaction against the so-called harmoniousness of the old China. So let us concede that there's a struggle for power in China. Let's concede that it is not being conducted by the Marquess of Queensberry's rules. Nevertheless, the crucial point that has to be made is that this Chinese power struggle is also a struggle over policies, or it's a struggle over revolutionary priorities, revolutionary strategies, let's say. And it's precisely this aspect of the struggle, ideological aspect, you might say, or the policy debate aspect, which does not get adequately reported in the West. As one distinguished American scholar recently remarked, if you want a demonstration of a power struggle that is almost purely concerned with the question of who exercises power and concerned hardly at all with ideological disagreements, the recent American presidential election between Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford is what you should look at, not the Chinese competition between Hua Guofeng and his supporters, and, as he's known in the Western press, is usually represented as being a sort of brusque, dispassionate, no-nonsense, economic manager type, a little like an Otto Lang with chopsticks. This picture is wrong. What's wrong with it? Up to a point, it's certainly true that the diverse supporters of the new chairman, Hua Guofeng, it's certainly true that they have emphasized what they regard as the impracticality and the lack of realism of Jiang Qing and of the Gang of Four, the other members of the Gang of Four. A recent Chinese newspaper article charged that the so-called Gang of Four, in demanding a thorough cultural revolution in China, naively believed that they could sweep away every vestige of the old Chinese culture and produce in its place a transparent pure land, or nirvana of emptiness. That is the paradise of popular Buddhism in the old China. It's charged in the Chinese press that this is what the Gang of Four wanted, a nirvana of emptiness as a result of a thorough cultural revolution, and that in this pure land they would construct worker class cultural mansions, unquote. Well, this mocking use of old-fashioned, otherworldly, Buddhist language to suggest the fantastic nature of the complete cultural purification that the Gang of Four supposedly wanted. This might seem to confirm our belief that Hua Guofeng and company are pragmatists, even by Chinese standards. I think that it would be closer to the truth to argue that the great Chinese battle that is going on right now is not so much between pragmatists and radicals as it is between social egalitarians, the Gang of Four, and the important constituency that they half represent, if that, especially in schools and communes and so on. A struggle between social egalitarians on the one hand and economic maximizers on the other hand. And these people are at the moment lined up behind Chairman Hua. Both the social egalitarians and the economic maximizers, I use these terms very tentatively, they're not wholly satisfactory, but it's very hard to find better ones. Both the social egalitarians and the economic maximizers regard themselves as pragmatic, if you like. Neither group has the slightest sympathy for Western democratic capitalism. In a sense, of course, Jiang Qing is a very incongruous symbolic leader of the people I call the social egalitarians. Enough independent evidence has emerged about her to indicate that she believed in more than equality for herself, and was a rather pampered woman and so on. So I'm really thinking, I'm trying to get beyond her, and I'm really thinking of many more people than her in a Communist Party, which we have to remember, the Chinese Communist Party, is its total membership is larger than the entire population of Canada. This is a big group, the ruling party of China. And there are a lot of people in this party, I think, who you could call them social egalitarians, and I'll try to explain what I mean by this, and in a funny way, they're half lined up behind the Gang of Four. The social egalitarians are not hostile to material growth. They dream of a Chinese society rich enough to be able to distribute goods to its 800 million people on a basis of individual need, rather than upon a basis of individual labor. They appear to fear that the very will to create such a society will be irretrievably buried beneath Western style or Soviet style patterns of industrialization, which create a worker class with heavily and permanently differentiated incomes, wages. So Zheng Chongqiao, who's one of the Gang of Four, supposedly commented in early 1975 that he would prefer to have a low rate of economic development in China that was socialist, as he called it, that is, a rate of economic development that did not create new social hierarchies. He would rather have that, a low rate of economic development that was socialist, rather than a high rate of economic development that was, as he put it, capitalist, in quotes. The economic maximizers, on the other hand, believe that they have to industrialize China rapidly in order to improve their workers' living standards quickly, and to defend China against the technologically advanced superpowers. Their ultimate goal may not be very different from that of their rivals, but they are more willing to risk the corrosion of that goal by their choice of methods to achieve it. In that sense, by Chinese revolutionary standards, they are the less cautious of the two groups and have a limited right to call the Gang of Four conservative. Each side is called the other conservative. Even in China, it depends on your point of view. Both the people that I have called the social egalitarians and the people that I reluctantly call the economic maximizers in China, both these people have appealed to the sacred memory of Yan'an. That is, they've appealed to the memory of the period between 1937 and 1945, when Mao Zedong's communist movement, domiciled in northern and northwestern China, created its own relatively self-sufficient guerrilla society and guerrilla economy. Both sides appeal to Yan'an, but they appeal to it in different ways. The social egalitarians insist that the lesson of Yan'an is that an ideal society can be created even in poor material circumstances in China. Yan'an, they say, was an ideal society in which officers and soldiers were equal, and soldiers and civilians were united, and everybody was opposed to grades or ranks, capitalist class ranks or grades, an equal and egalitarian society, and it could be created even when you had poverty. That's their side of it. The economic maximizers insist that the lesson of Yan'an is that the survival of the revolution required the revolutionaries to undertake a forced draft production of food and clothing and other economic necessities in order to overcome the effects of the economic blockade which Chiang Kai-shek and the Japanese army had imposed upon Yan'an. In a blockaded society, as they put it, questions of material production have to come first, and so on. This epic debate over revolutionary strategies is taking place within a political system whose methods of dialogue are, paradoxically, both extraordinarily crude and also, at the same time, extraordinarily subtle. And it really is amazing. It would be hard to think of any political system which can be more crude and more subtle at the same time. The crude methods are represented by the so-called big character posters, the dazibao, which appear in profusion on the walls of Chinese buildings with a sort of kaleidoscopic seductiveness if you're a Western reporter living in China. And these big character posters which appear on the walls, they offer a dangerous temptation to Westerners because you're apt to run out and translate the latest one and try to decide what's going on in Chinese politics on the basis of what you see. There's a long tradition of Western interpretation of big character posters. The first foreigners, as far as I know, to read these big character posters systematically were probably British diplomats in the southern city of Canton in December of 1838. The British carefully translated the scurrilous wall posters which appeared on the walls of the Guangdong Governor's Palace in 1838. These wall posters attacked the Cantonese governor for corruption and nepotism. And the British translated these wall posters very carefully and promptly concluded from the translations that the governor was unpopular with the masses. It was only much later that they realized that the wall posters had been written at night by a number of opium dealers whom the governor had just fined, and that the force behind the wall posters was squalid personal revenge-seeking and really had nothing to do with idealistic popular outrage. Western journalists who rely upon interpreting big character posters in Peking in 1977 in order to puff up their stories run almost precisely the same risks as those British diplomats did in Canton back in 1838. Subtle methods of dialogue, what are they? Well, as far as the more subtle methods of dialogue of the Chinese political system are concerned, past and present, you have only to think of such things as the 17th century Chinese painter, hostile to the Qing dynasty, who expressed his extremely strong political sentiments against the Qing dynasty merely by painting a picture of three purple melons. He simply assumed that everybody who saw the painting of the three purple melons would automatically remember a saying by Confucius, "I hate the purple for taking the place of vermilion," and would also recall that the word vermilion, Zhu, was also the surname of the unfortunate dynastic house which the hated Qing dynasty had just got rid of. In 18th century China, you would get great philosophers writing books about Mencius and so on, which there wasn't a word of criticism of the dynasty in them, but in fact they were attacking the dynasty for its debauching the Confucian classics for political reasons. If you get a Chinese scholar today who writes a book on Marx, it may be an attack on people in China for not being good Marxists and so on. Oblique forms of political protest like this, they're heavily dependent upon a rich knowledge of Chinese history and Chinese philosophy. They're very fashionable in China. They're extremely fashionable in China today. And I can assure you, they are sometimes almost completely undecipherable by Western scholars and journalists. How about the Chinese masses? How do they participate in these more subtle forms of dialogue? Well, to help the Chinese masses themselves participate in political dialogues of this more subtle type, Peking publishing houses flood the country with so-called simplified histories of Chinese philosophy, such as the one by Yang Rongguo, which is circulating now. These political dialogues are essentially bookish, or scripturalist, you might say, in nature. They may be taking place in discussion groups all over China, but they're sort of bookish types of discussion. In 1976, you have to keep in mind the environment in which all this is taking place. In 1976, there were only 37 television stations in all of China, reinforced by 123 television relay stations to serve a population of 800 or 900 million people. Educational television in China, educational television broadcasts in China, they were begun in the huge city of Shanghai less than 2 years ago, in July of 75. They apparently reach an audience of only about 150,000 people out of in a city of many millions. In other words, for those of you who are fanciers of the theories of Marshall McLuhan, China is just beginning to enter the television age. And so these very sophisticated forms of political dialogue of the old days in China are still very much intact, I would say, with a Marxist transformation. Because this is a political system whose modes of expression are both extraordinarily crude and extraordinarily subtle, it's not always easy to get a total idea of what you might call the platforms of the two sides in the current struggle. Until October of 1976, the Chinese press was controlled by the people whom I have called the social egalitarians. They would take the arguments of their opponents, such as the venerable, durable politician Deng Xiaoping, and they would cast these arguments in a kind of mock logic. A little like the pronouncements of the fools in Shakespearean plays, in a way. And you have to read between the lines to get a picture of what Deng was saying. Now the economic maximizers have control of the press, and they're meeting out the same treatment to the people who controlled the press before October. But one thing I think is clear. The strength of the social egalitarians, it may ultimately prove to be politically inadequate. That certainly seems to be the most likely thing you could say. But it does, I think, reach well beyond the immediate entourage of the so-called Gang of Four. The question is, how many thousands of teenagers and young men and women are there in China today who have recently graduated from middle schools, high schools, and been sent down to the countryside to staff production brigades and various commune organs and so on? How many people are there in China of that type who are sincerely convinced of the validity of the scathing attack against Deng Xiaoping, which one 18-year-old member of the social egalitarians, Zhou Huantao, published in Chinese newspapers last summer? This young man, Zhou Huantao, attacked Deng Xiaoping and the other economic maximizers for their adherence to what the Chinese call the foundations theory. The foundations theory. Namely, the theory that China must improve its material foundations, its economy. China must expand its economic and industrial production, its economic foundations, before inequitable institutions like the differentiated wages system in industry can be abolished. Now, obviously, the theme of this debate, how much social leveling can the economy afford? Obviously, the theme of that debate is not a peculiarly Chinese theme. You find it raising its head all over the world, and it has raised its head in our own country. The Chinese context of that debate, equality now or equality later after we've expanded the material foundations, the Chinese context of that debate is very different from our own. For one thing, the debate is embedded in a sort of doctrinal controversy. You might even say it's embedded in a religious controversy. A dispute among true believers over just how egalitarian the communist millennium is supposed to be. For another thing, there's the historical background, terribly important. For example, our newspapers tell us today, probably correctly, that one reason why West Germany today pursues conservative economic policies in order to keep down its rate of inflation is that the Germans, including German socialists, have very traumatic recollections of the hyperinflation in Weimar Germany in the 1920s. The Chinese debate over equality of consumption versus expanded material production, this debate occurs in a society with even more traumatic recollections of vast famines in the 1930s and 1940s. You have to remember that 30 years ago or 40 years ago in China, it was not uncommon to pick up a local newspaper and read about peasants burying arsenic in stuffed dumplings and then feeding the dumplings to their entire families. But this is an actual story from a Hangzhou newspaper of 1934, when these peasants were expropriated from their lands or their rice crops failed or something like that. Mass suicide or starvation and that sort of thing. Between 1949 and the present, the population of China has increased about 60%, from 500 millions in 1949 to 800 millions today. Thanks to a very tangible social and economic revolution, and thanks, of course, in obviously very much smaller measure to Saskatchewan wheat imports, this population has not been harrowed by the famines, which were such fatal Chinese commonplaces before 1949. But if genuine popular pressure exerts itself in the current debate in China, whose side is it going to take? I think it's reasonable to assume that if the people I've called the economic maximizers win, they will still have to guarantee considerable equality of consumption. If the Gang of Four, or a more reputable group which believes the ideas which the Gang of Four is sort of associated with, if this side wins, as seems less likely at the moment, their victory will be very short-lived unless they can keep the economy growing. In other words, the Chinese population seems to have come to expect both. How does the current Chinese policy debate, policy struggle, how does it affect China's relations with the West? My own impression is that both the economic maximizers and the social egalitarians are, at bottom, skeptical of Western, and by Western I include Soviet, inspirations and relationships. But I think the logic of the position of the social egalitarians makes them more skeptical of the West. In education, for example, the social egalitarians have attacked Deng Xiaoping and others for wishing to restore the Chinese educational system of 1949-1966, an educational system which the social egalitarians claim was too inflexible and much too concentrated in the cities and towns, and which discriminated against the children of poor peasants. The social egalitarians have demanded, instead, an educational system controlled by the poor, lower, and middle peasants. In practice, this means an education system dominated by school management committees made up of peasant and worker representatives. The total number of peasant and worker representatives on school management committees in China in 1976 was 3,700,000. That's not as big as it sounds. If you work that figure out in Canadian terms, reduce it to Canadian scale, it works out to about the same as 100,000 school board citizen representatives across Canada. I don't know how many there are, but 100,000 doesn't seem too unrealistic a Canadian term if you think of all the school boards there are in this country. So this is not necessarily quite the Athenian democracy in education that the social egalitarians claim. But it certainly is an educational revolution by past Chinese standards. The assault against city-centered elitism in Chinese education since 1966 has been a massive assault. And as part of this assault against city-centered elitism, the social egalitarians evidently made the Peking Foreign Languages Institute one of their special educational targets. They also, apparently, adopted a position of great hostility to the teaching of foreign languages in Chinese primary schools. In other words, to the social egalitarians, too much emphasis upon foreign expertise and even upon foreign languages seems to lead inevitably to the creation of specialized elites in China. It seems to lead to the emergence of invidious, what the Chinese call foreign affairs cliques, yangwupai, foreign affairs cliques, elites who specialize in managing foreign relations. In a vast peasant society, it's difficult to combine real educational egalitarianism with foreign educational subjects, which all peasants may not find easy or necessary to absorb or apply. So inevitably, it seems to me, the Equality Party in the Chinese Revolution, the one which is insisting on equality right now, is not going to be enthusiastic about Westernization in China, because the spread of Western influences is, by its very nature, socially uneven. I want to stress that I'm not talking about the China of 100 years ago. When you talk about lack of enthusiasm for Western influences in China, it seems to me you immediately run the risk of conjuring up memories of 19th century dynastic China, where far-sighted reformers were often reduced to the position of pretending that modern Western chemistry had really been invented by Chinese Taoist philosophers of the 3rd century BC, or that modern Western physics had originated with the Chinese philosopher Zhu Xi in the 12th century, and that therefore it's okay for Chinese governments to take an interest in Western science because such science is really Chinese. That was the line 100 years ago. Or you run the risk of thinking of 19th century Chinese situations. This one is not too uncharacteristic, I think. A situation like the one where the servant girls of a Chinese government bureaucrat 100 years ago showed some interest in becoming Christians. When this happened in a southwest China city in 1881, the servant girls of the Mandarin said that they were becoming Christians. The government bureaucrat involved gave a sharp warning to his servant girls about the Western missionaries to which they'd been innocently listening. He said to his servant girls, quote, "The West produces nothing good. It is the East that is noted for its productions. This is true in this life and also in future lives. These foreigners know this, and so they come to China, and thus they gain in life or in death. If you believe the doctrine they preach, when you die, your souls will go to England, and you will suffer terribly. The China of 1977, that is the China of hydrogen bombs and open-heart surgery, the China of 1977 is not the China of 1881. But the great issue of the borrowing of foreign technology is still a major storm center in Chinese politics. I would say more so than in any other Western, non-Western society. It's been a storm center for more than a century. It still is a storm center in slightly different ways. The social egalitarians, or at least the Gang of Four, have formally asserted, or at least we're told by their enemies, that any Chinese government official who sanctions the importation into China of new foreign technologies and new foreign equipment, any Chinese government official who does this, sanctions this, is suffering from a foreign enslavement philosophy. That is, he's allowing himself to become the dependent of foreign capitalist classes, the argument goes, and is therefore a member of that great agency of evil in Chinese history, a foreign affairs clique, Yang Wupai. In other words, there seems to be an entrenched fear that skill in managing China's relations with the West, skill in managing China's adaptations of Western industry and science, will become a decisive political influence within the Chinese government, permitting elites to emerge whose foreign-derived expertise is too arcane to be challenged by ordinary citizens. The economic maximizers reply that the borrowing of advanced new techniques and equipment from foreign countries is not a contradiction of Chinese self-reliance, because Chinese industrial borrowers carefully follow a four-stage formula for borrowing, which the late Zhou Enlai laid down. This four-stage formula was that first you use the new foreign technology. Secondly, you criticize the foreign technology. Thirdly, you change the foreign technology. And fourthly, you create a new technology which is authentically Chinese. The Peking Ministry of Light Industry, for example, is currently arguing right now that China's new chemical fibers industry is a shining vindication of the late Zhou Enlai's use, criticize, change, and create formula. The line which the Ministry of Light Industry is pushing right now is that in capitalist countries, it generally requires 20 or 30 years for annual chemical fibers production.